Welcome to the CSPW podcast. My name is Tom Ahern, and today I'm here with Dr. Adam Banks, a professor at Syracuse University. Welcome, Dr. Banks.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
You recently published a book called Race, Rhetoric, and Technology, Searching for Higher Ground. And in general, I've noticed your work features a creative approach to the intersection of three traditionally distinct fields of study, composition, technology, and race. Could you tell us how you began to focus on these connections?
A lot of things were happening at the same time, I guess, as the idea started to germinate. You know, one of the things that happened somewhere in the mid-90s was I was tired of trying to push myself into that round peg of being a lit scholar or a lit graduate student hoping to be a scholar. And so I started making the switch over into RetComp and TechCom as a way of getting out of that straitjacket. And at the same time, that was when the digital divide started to emerge as a concept. What was fascinating to me was how people were trying to leverage that term in order to do some work on behalf of Black folks, but the approaches to technology, the approaches to activism seemed very stripped down. So even though I wasn't very technically inclined at the time, I knew that there had to be something more there, and I knew that there had to be some more thorough engagements with technology among Black folk. And so the pieces sort of fell together all in sometimes weird, sometimes serendipitous ways. One example that I cite in the book that really helped to bring all of this home for me, though, was when I worked for Cleveland Public Library. They were starting to get systems into the branches to improve their sense of what access was. And it was such a narrow sense of access. The assumption was simply, if we put these computers in here, the skies will open up.
Right,
everything
right.
will be equal. The kids will get all the information that they need. And then they got upset when the kids wanted to download lyrics and they were dumping this stuff on the kids as if something is somehow wrong with them, rather than thinking about what they were doing programmatically. So that was the moment where I knew. You can know something intellectually, but I knew in my gut at that point that these notions of access had to be complicated.
Right. And even today, when you go to any public library, those computers are always full and always in use. When you first heard about the digital divide, was it just part of the public rhetoric when the study came out? You noticed it at the library, but did you notice it on other levels or as far as technology? Or what was your experience with technology, I guess, at that time?
I was aware of the conversation starting to form around the digital divide, right? There was Larry Irving in the Clinton administration, and there was the sense that Clinton was somehow trying to do something about this. In terms of my own relationships to technologies, they were nascent at the time, and for a moment, I had the sort of, not quite Luddite, but the grumpy humanist position. Right. I'd rather interact in person. I don't want to be bothered with all of this stuff. But at the same time, I knew that there was important critique in that position, too. So I didn't want to dismiss it entirely.
Right.
So I had to force myself into new spaces to learn and do different things and to acquire some literacies and some abilities that I did not have at that time.
And as you began to learn technology, did you notice the issues of race coming up from the beginning as far as how technology was set up?
Absolutely. It's everything around computers and the internet as they became so popular, just as Cindy and Dickie write about the office metaphor dominating so much of what the computer came to be. It was such a corporate model. It was such a straight-jacketed kind of approach that when I was thinking about the issues that Black folk face, it was hard initially for me to think about how technologies could speak to those issues because,
But it seems like technology is just so standard. We just take it for granted that it is what it is.
Absolutely. So for me, I was resisting a lot of that and feeling like, those definitions, those narratives had to be interrupted in some way. And I hadn't quite arrived at the language to talk about how maybe they should be interrupted or what Black folks should bring to the technology, because the initial conversations about access always assumed that the people or the individual seeking access had to make all the concessions,
right,
had to learn the skills, had to figure out the conventions and the codes without any conversation about how technology makers, for example, were going to make these tools relevant to Black and Latino audiences, or how they were going to make even the language and the interfaces more appealing and more attractive, or the design choices that they make. So none of that two-way conversation that we might expect with other things was happening with technology, and that was troubling to me.
Right. And especially throughout your work, you comment on this fully developed field called African-American rhetoric. So it's not like there weren't patterns and rituals and practices to bring into that design. Could you discuss with some specifics what African-American rhetoric is to you?
Yeah, for me, I define it as the full range of traditions and practices. So verbal, print, visual, digital, and I would also say performative. Those practices and those experiences that set the conditions for how persuasion happens within African-Americans as a group of people and in their experiences with the larger nation. So, for example, the contribution that I try to make to African-American rhetoric scholarship is to move it beyond the page, to move it beyond the study of the exemplars. Well, we're going to look at how Dr. King's dream speech works or how Malcolm's Ballad or the Bullet speech works and try to open up the entire range of communicative practices. So, for example, even the way that a church service is put together, the way that it's sequenced, the way that it's ordered, has a rhetorical function in that that sequencing, that ordering is about creating a certain experiences. So there are elements of persuasion that happen there. The rhetorical is present in everyday activities like how people walk, how they greet each other, how they perform their identities. The fact that when I walk across campus at Syracuse University and I see some black students, some of them will give me that head nod acknowledging my presence and some of them will not because they aren't quite participating in certain discourse communities in that way. Or maybe they have mixed feelings about participating in those discourse communities. And so the verbal, the visual, the print, the textual, the performative all come together for me. And so what I try to do is strike a balance between a careful look at tradition and a careful look at present sort of individual performances, individual people finding their ways through those chords, if you will, to find ways to play their own individual melodies. So that's basically my sense of how it works.
It seems like it'd be a very challenging thing, though, to try to explain to those not within the discourse communities how things work like that on such a simple level, but yet they're so complicated.
Absolutely.
To kind of take that even further to the next step, then you kind of bring that back to look at the digital divide and then talk about how the digital divide, what we think of as a technological problem, is really a discursive problem.
Yeah, that's a really important issue for me. To even be able to complicate this notion of access, I had to move the conversation beyond this idea of access being just about the material. Because if we think about technology as just the material, if we think about it as just the stuff, the wires, the code, the case, that allows us to keep a kind of a positivist view of not just technology, but the knowledge is involved in its design and creation. And if I've got a positivist notion of how all this stuff works, that lets me keep the gates in the same places that they've always been. Because in other words, those who have not been in the conversation obviously simply have not done what they need to deserve to be in the conversation.
Right.
And so I knew I had to change that game. And so when we think about technologies as processes and artifacts, and then we think about the conditions that lead even to the creation of the artifacts, that helps me get at the rhetorical nature of every element of a technology. So from the writing of content to the writing of policies to the ways in which technologies are marketed to the ways in which those marketing decisions influence design to the ways in which people argue about the best design approaches to take in a given moment. Everything, so not just the processes, but even the artifacts, too, end up being grounded in rhetorical practice. And that is the path, I think, that we need for being able to complicate what access means.
Speaking of access, a lot of times you refer to a type of access called transformative access, and particularly that refers to people of color trying to get into dominant white culture in a more than token kind of way.
Absolutely.
So could you talk about how transformative access works, or has it actually happened in certain spots?
I think there are transformative moments. What I'm up to in trying to work that phrase transformative access is to say that when we look at the African-American rhetorical tradition, for example, we find that there's always a kind of dialectic going on between participation and resistance. And that when we look at the movements or productive moments in that history, we always find some kind of synthesis between participation and resistance. It's not some blind resistance simply throwing rocks at the system for the sake of critique. And at the same time, it's not this kind of accommodationist-driven willingness to do anything and everything just for the sake of access on the terms governed, that the system would say should govern that participation. So The idea is that in everything that African Americans have done in this country, black folk have always found a kind of synthesis between the two. And it's in that synthesis that transformative work can happen. And I don't argue that that's always the result, but I argue that that always should be the goal. So in other words, our work with technology should not be just about, well, we need to own technology. Just owning technology or just using technology, all that really means is you're giving Microsoft and Sun Microsystems and everybody else some more money.
Right.
How do you make that relevant for the needs of a people? And so what I try to do is encourage black folks to not see this duality between the needs that they think might keep them from addressing technology issues. Well, we got to deal with that later. We got police brutality. We got a prison industrial complex. We have HIV AIDS. We got a crack epidemic that still has influence on what's happening. But rather to flip that up and say, how can technological acts, processes, forms of communication help us to address those issues so that there's always a fusion. And so our uses of technologies are relevant. They're grounded not just in addressing the activist needs, but also in the everyday needs of a people. So it's not driven by a notion of the problem all the time. And at the same time, it's not a sort of blind acceptance of whatever the man tells us we have to do and buy and, you know, in order to participate.
And it seems kind of your discourse there on how technology works and people's expectations and access is typical of some of the things you write about in the book in terms of Jeremiah's. Throughout black culture, there's been these people who discuss these beliefs that have been put forward by dominant white culture that this is how things should be. And then the Jeremiah in the oral tradition or on paper would talk about what is wrong and how these promises are never kept. And you do a good job of pointing out, I think, that the job of the Jeremiah isn't necessarily to give solutions. But I think in a sophisticated move on your part, you do talk about the problems, but you don't make the solutions so far off. There are ways to change things. And a lot of that comes in, I think, with your discussion of design, which you briefly mentioned earlier. And you go through examples from music to sports to even quilt making. So I was wondering if you could talk about how design operates in African-American culture.
Well, it's interesting that you sort of linked your question about design to the previous chapter where I'm working through some things with the Jeremiad and Jeremiah's throughout the tradition, because I do see them as being two sides of the same coin. In other words, when we think about rhetorical work, especially when you're looking at what black folks and other folk of color deal with in this space, you have to have some people who are willing to be bold enough to bring the Jeremiadic kind of vision that, look, we are doomed if we don't get right, that there is serious systemic stuff here that we must address, and that our health as a society, our future as a collective people, as an America, depends on it, just like the futures of individual groups like black folk depend on it as well. And so what happens with Jeremiadic figures, though, is that many times they are critiqued themselves, maybe for not coming through with the 10-point plan the path to liberation after they've made their move. And so my point is that critique and design must work together, but it doesn't have to be the same figure who's going to represent both sides of that work. And so when it comes to design, what I'm up to is essentially a kind of participatory model of design where, however we might say, the folk or those who have been denied access still have an active role in making design decisions, in helping to create tools, spaces, and processes that are relevant for their lives. The important thing there, though, is that we have to make sure there is room for them at the table and we don't allow the same old assumptions about who belongs and who does not belong because of this kind of longstanding myth of meritocracy that we still believe in, or we still, even if we don't believe in it entirely, we still leverage it to keep folk out when we want to keep them out. So we still got to create that room at the table. So you've got to have those Jeremiadic figures to blow up the spot, if you will, or in my colleague Gwen Pugh's language, to bring wreck to the situation. But the deconstructive move by itself is never enough.
Right.
That we've got to come into those newly cleared spaces on the other side and be willing to imagine new spaces, new tools, where, in the words of folk in a community class I teach, where they would say, Just act like you're free. Don't worry about whatever might be in the way of freedom right now. But, you know, imagine that new space or that new future without those boundaries. So that's kind of what I'm trying to get at.
I notice you do a lot of work in the community you work in far as trying to integrate the academy to the real world. Could you talk about some of the ways you've used writing or composition or even technology to try to bridge that gap that often seems very wide?
There's a whole lot I want to say here. I'm trying to think of how I can answer this question quickly. But what I'm up to basically is this. A lot of times when we think of community literacy, we think of somehow taking our skills and expertise out to the people in an attempt to have them build similar skills. That skills approach does absolutely squat for me. So what I've tried to do is flip the script. Instead of going to community to build literacy, I've tried to use literacy to build community. And so what I've tried to do is engage Syracuse's Black community in a kind of constant conversation where we take up the big issues, we deal with the big difficult questions, even though that doesn't necessarily mean that we'll find immediate solutions, but that we're involved in that process. And for me, that's that just act like you're free work, the ability to imagine the new space, to imagine something different. So each semester I take a different topic, sometimes connected with the class I'm teaching on campus, and take those texts and explore them with members of Syracuse's Black community who range in class, they range in age, they range in education. And the whole point is just to create a space where we can all be and where we can all engage the conversations in ways in which we really do hear each other. So I've done surveys of African-American rhetoric where the purpose was to get people involved in the debates and come to their own positions. We've done courses that kind of look at Malcolm X and Martin King's political philosophies and the sort of creative tension and synthesis between the two. We've looked at Black women's writing. We've looked at hip hop as an instrument for change instead of just the stereotype. One of the courses that I call Afrofuturism, Communities, Technology, Struggle, asked people to do some of that same design work or redesign work. So the topic changes every semester, but the goal is simply to get us looking into our traditions more deeply and using that look into the tradition as a way of imagining free futures. And it might be the one thing that has kept me in Syracuse for these 5 years, because it's incredibly fulfilling work. I constantly get re-energized by what I hear the communities talking about and the level to which they're willing to engage these big, difficult questions. So that's what the work has been.
So who do you find is more receptive then when you try to bring the two communities together? Is one more fearful than the other, or is there a welcoming type of vibe that happens?
I think there's a welcoming type of vibe that happens. I also think that that type of vibe has to be created. Many college and university students, when they do get off the hill, when they do get off campus, it's often under a kind of service learning model, or you know, which for me carries all that old missionary baggage.
Like they're coming as students, not people.
Exactly. And so that puts a very serious boundary around the kinds of interaction that can happen. And so I've tried to create events and spaces where that's absolutely not the approach, where we're simply coming together in these conversations. And sometimes there are logistical challenges that make it tough. So, for example, none of us has money to get transportation for the students so that they can actually physically get to the spaces. Or if I do the events on campus and I've got some of my elderly community members coming up, Syracuse literally and for most of its history figuratively has tried to be that city on a hill. And so physical access issues of actually, you know, getting up there, being able to find decent parking. So logistical things get in the way. It's delicate work handling the conversation so that everyone can be heard and everyone is urged, cajoled to really hear each other. But I believe that there's a growing receptiveness on both sides.
I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about music. I know the theme runs through a good deal of your work. And today you're going to give a talk on the mixtape. So, and I noticed you offer an assignment in your writing classes about the mixtape, too. So I was wondering, we can talk about that new kind of cultural phenomenon of the mixtape a bit.
Yeah, what I'm trying to do with the notion of the mixtape, or if you want to take these rhetorical practices within hip-hop more broadly, the sample, the mix, the remix, the mixtape, I'm trying to step to them in ways where the treatment is grounded in the realities of African-American culture and not just completely lifted outside those contexts as a, ooh, look at this cool artifact. So, for example, we have a few people within retcon theory who have come to appreciate the value of the sample or the value of the mix, but as an artifact that they try to lift from the realities of African-American culture. And so there's this kind of postmodern, they're sort of sampling those who do the sampling, right? But what I'm trying to suggest this afternoon is that there are deep and powerful ways in which these rhetorical practices take place in African-American culture as well, no matter how else they might come to signify outside the culture, that allow a synthesis of very different positions, very different approaches, very different forms of knowledge. And in this particular case, they allow a kind of generational synthesis or a chance to bridge this generational chasm that I believe is so much a part of this current cultural moment, where many people are looking back feeling like even after these incredible gains of the civil rights movement that we've lost, really, we've lost so much that even threatens those gains. And so in that feeling of loss, in that moment of, wow, what has happened in these last 40 years? How are we still here? A lot of that frustration has those generational tones to it. Well, the young people are too materialistic these days, or the young people don't want to learn, or back in the day, young people used to respect their elders, or we used to discipline the kids back in the day. So what I'm saying that the mixtape allows us is ways of bringing together the knowledge, the needs, the cultural performances of our elders and our young people, so that we see that what's at work is not some permanent disruption of the culture between these generations, but what the literary critic Deborah McDowell would call a changing same. And it's my hope that as we enact in these kinds of practices of synthesis, that we can create some of the kinds of unities that it will take to push greater action to actually, you know, to really heal the issues that folks are facing. So to give you a short version of the answer to the question you've asked, I'm saying that the mixtape can work as a kind of conceptual metaphor or a model of the kinds of layering of various different experiences that we need if you're ever going to have real conversation across gender, because across gender too, but across generation, because in this moment where we act as if somehow the young folk in hip hop have come and effed everything up, that what we have in hip hop, if we get beyond the silly debates about representation and look at how it works rhetorically, what we have in hip hop is a generation that is actively, achingly searching for connection with that previous generation. So where much of the time we assume that the young folks want to completely discard what their elders were doing through the sample, through the fact that P-Funk and James Brown are the most sample artists in all of hip hop, and that people like Sam Cooke and Minnie Riperton and Etta James and Donny Hathaway are now sampled too. For me, that represents a search. That represents a desire to connect rather than the chasm. So if we honor those practices in the sample, the mix, the remix, and the mixtape, we have a chance of actually healing some of those ruptures that aren't about the young folks versus the old folks. They're about deindustrialization. Right. They're about global capitalism. They're about the continued dehumanization of black people and the stereotypes that still occur to this day. So that's sort of what I'm trying to work toward there.
You make some great points about the young people trying to find the connections to the older crowd, but a lot of times the older crowd isn't open-minded to the fact that even if they aren't the greatest first steps, they are steps. And even when you kind of talked about the computer and the library access, where even if kids are looking up lyrics or things that older people might find offensive, you seem to have a very open-minded take on, you know, the lightness of some younger people's technology use. Is there a way to kind of bridge between the two? Because it seems you are somewhat in the middle and you have a definite appreciation for, quote, old school culture, but as problematic as you may find certain parts of new school culture, you do see that connection there that isn't very frequently addressed.
Absolutely. For me, this is where some of the stuff that we talk about in terms of multi-literacies, multimedia literacies, new literacies, if you follow James G. and those folks. This technological moment offers us real opportunity. The need to preserve and document elements of a culture that is always under threat, that is always under that is always being appropriated by very many people, it creates the chance for that link. What I'm getting at is I'm trying to work this concept that I call the digital griot, this figure who is a master at working print, oral, and digital technologies and literacies. And so I believe that this need to reclaim the tradition, this need to find answers for right now, and this need to be able to work futuristic visions and deal with technologies that seem to be changing at, you know, ever more rapid paces, it sets up the need for this kind of connection between our elders and our young people. So one of the things that I want to do is put them together in exploring these different kinds of literacies together. So in other words, with this kind of digital griot outlook that I'm talking about, let's say if I have a project over a summer and I pair an elder and a young person together, and we have a session where we're going through some of the folk tales, the Br'er Rabbit tales, Signifying Monkey, Stagger Lee, all this wonderful stuff in the tradition. One of the things that I want them to do, I want the elders to have their say on how this stuff operated in the culture. Then I want my young folks to talk about what they believe are the current manifestations of that. So if we talk about the Shine story, what do we do with the fact that there is a rapper who has named himself Shine? What do we do with the fact that Steve Harvey intentionally invoked the Shine narrative in Kings of Comedy as a way of talking about beauty in black cultures, right? So we can take the tradition, we can see how it manifests in the current moment, we can see how young folks have their take on whatever might have changed in that current moment, and then we can think about how we preserve these things together and enact them in some kind of way to address the issues that we face. So I want that rich conversation about the oral tradition. Then I want us doing some writing based on it and some reflecting based on it. And I want us thinking about how we use digital technologies to preserve and to share that tradition. So how do we digitize the oral tradition? How do we oraltize, if you will, the digital? How do we bring all of that together in this constant conversation? And by doing that, not only do we get a chance to think about productive solutions for things we face now, but we get to get our young folks and our elders on the one instead of feeling like, well, we're just in these irreconcilable camps here and it's going to be that way.
Right. And the notion of the one does come up quite a bit. Originally, in your book, you mentioned it in terms of funkadelic or James Brown type music where there's freedom, but always coming back on the one. And that continues today. I'm thinking in particular of your work on the slow jam in terms of it's always been a part of African-American music, R&B in particular, but that continues today. So is that kind of one example maybe of how bringing together that working within this content, working in the form of the slow jam, but then having the same content, maybe it's similar, maybe it's different, but we still always have that slow jam, it seems like.
I certainly hope that we always have that slow jam. There's a very popular song right now where the artist says something like, "Hey DJ, please don't play another slow jam." You know, and think about how different that is from Midnight Star in 1982 talking about, "Please play another slow jam." But, you know, and when I'm in my sort of grousing, you know, when I'm being one of the old men in the balcony on the Muppets, my sort of back in the day story is black folk don't slow dance no more. You don't go out to the club and you hear that set of slow jams that when I was a young buck, even if I couldn't get a slow dance, I waited all night for that set because there was such beauty in what would happen, you know, after folks have danced and sweated all night, but they crave that moment of having some kind of other connection with each other. So I've kind of jokingly argued that that's been under threat lately, but to come back to the point, though, I do think it endures. I do think it maintains and that it will continue even as the forms change. And I guess how this comes back to the idea of the one, a different version I sort of referenced a while ago was this idea of the changing same that McDowell talks about. The One, the reason that what P-Funk was up to with The One is the major conceptual metaphor for the book for me. The thing I really tried to hook this entire book on is that I got really, really tired of the hard postmodern argument when it came to race and culture. This argument that, well, you always have to complicate that there's no one black experience. There's no one this experience. There's no one women's experience. Of course that's true. But at the same time, the harder versions of that postmodern argument, you know, that there's nothing that we could identify as black in this moment because everything is constantly changing, that's nonsense. It's always been constantly changing.
Right.
And so as people find the kind of productive unities they can in a particular moment, that's where the definitions are put down. And of course, those definitions will be different in one moment than they were in the past. And they'll be different among different among varying groups of black folk. But I never hear anybody saying there's no French identity because there are, you know, 25 or 30 million French people all with different experiences. I never hear people saying there's no American identity. So the idea that I was trying to get to was the fact that we can have concepts that describe something that we might feel is going on with a group of people without tying everybody in a group of people to that idea. That even for someone who plays against whatever the operative idea might be, that does not mean there's not still power in the operative idea. So, for example, people want to talk a lot of times about how you have many black people who don't speak African-American English. Duh, of course. But that does not mean that there's not still power in these patterns that we come to understand as African-American English. And so I needed a model. I needed a way to talk about unity that did not sort of demand some blind adherence to a set of principles, you know, that understood that these things are always in play, that they're always sort of, to use the old internet metaphor, everything's always under construction. So that's sort of how I got to The One. The point you're making about the slow jam as this kind of current manifestation of it, I've really got to play with that a while. I keep waiting for, you know, how everything in culture, whether it's, you know, American culture, Latino culture, black culture, it's cyclical. I keep waiting for that moment where the slow jam comes back and people are willing to shed that notion of hardness and be willing to be vulnerable again. And I know it's still there in sort of muted ways.
Right.
But I keep waiting for that moment where it comes back as a major space in the culture. I don't know what that's going to take, you know, but I do believe it's coming.
All right. Well, I think that's a great way to end on The One, so to speak. So
there you go.
Thank you, Dr. Banks, for visiting OSU and spending some time to talk with us today.
Thank you so much for such a generous read and for your engaging questions. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.